So we're going to be Mark chapter 5, verse 21 through 43, combined with Matthew 9 and Luke 8. So the basic text here is Mark chapter 5, and in the brackets are places where the other synoptic gospels deviate a little bit. And when Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side, a great crowd, expecting him, gathered about him, and he was beside the sea. Then came one of the rulers of the synagogue, Jairus by name, and knelt before him. And seeing him, he fell at his feet and implored him earnestly to come to his house, saying, "My little daughter, only daughter, about 12, is at the point of death or has just died. Come and lay your hands on her so that she may be made well and live." And he went with him. And a great crowd followed him and thronged about him, almost crushed him. And there was a woman who had a discharge of blood for 12 years, and who had suffered much under many physicians, and had spent all that she had, and was no better than, but rather grew worse. She had heard the reports about Jesus, and came up behind him in the crowd, and touched the edge of his garment. For she said, "If I touch even his garments, I'll be made well." And immediately the flow of blood dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. And Jesus, perceiving in himself that power had gone out from him, immediately turned about in the crowd and said, "Who touched my garments?" When they all denied it, Peter said, "Master," and his disciples said to him, "You see the crowd pressing around you, and yet you say, 'Who touched me?'" But Jesus said, "Someone touched me, and I know that power has gone out of me." And he looked around to see who had done it. But the woman, seeing that she could not go unnoticed, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling, and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. In the presence of all the people, she told why she had touched him and how she had been instantly healed. And he said to her, "Take heart, daughter. Your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease." While he was still speaking, there came from the ruler's house some who said, "Your daughter's dead. Why?" Or, "Don't trouble the teacher any further." But overhearing what they said, Jesus said to the ruler of the synagogue, that's Jairus, "Do not fear, only believe, and she will be healed." And he allowed no one to follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James, and the child's mother and father. They came to the house of the ruler of the synagogue, and Jesus saw a commotion and flute players, people weeping and wailing loudly. And when he had entered, he said to them, "Why are you making such a commotion and weeping? Stop wailing. Go away. The child is not dead, but sleeping." And they laughed at him, knowing that she was dead. And he put them all outside and took the child's father and mother and those who were with him and went in where the child was. Taking her by the hand, he said to her, "Talitha kumi," which means, "Little girl, my child, I say to you, arise." Her spirit returned, and immediately the girl got up and began walking, for she was 12 years of age, and they and her parents were immediately overcome with amazement, and he strictly charged them that no one would know this, and he told them to give her something to eat. And news of this spread throughout all the region. So this morning we get two stories for the price of one. You have this very unusual situation where the story is moving one direction, and then there's this major interruption in the middle of it all, and then we come back to the main story itself. Now, for those of you who were here 2 weeks ago when we were last together, where was Jesus prior to this event?
Across the Sea of Galilee.
He was in the southern end of the Sea of Galilee.
Throw the pens on the ground, it's always helpful. Okay. Jesus was down here with the Gerasene demoniac, and now he's back here, Capernaum. So he had a round trip ticket on the boat. A little turbulent on the way, but not quite so turbulent going back. So we had him crossing the sea with the big, the big storm in the middle. He gets here, heals the demoniac, and the people embraced him and celebrated the fact that he did it.
For their sake?
No. They all said, "You're scaring us. go away.
He goes, okay. He gets in the boat, and he goes all the way back to Capernaum.
This is very interesting. This whole idea of his itinerary seems so incredibly intentional, and we miss it because we're focusing on all the other events around it. But Jesus took a trip down here, and now he's back. He left this area the last time. The crowds were so intense. He was having to get in boats, pull off the edge of the sea, talk to them all. He went to the house to get something to eat, and the crowds were following. When he started on this journey, remember, boats followed them. They probably turned around during the storm and went back home because they were, you're nuts to keep going. Well, we'll see when you get back. So he comes back to the same place that he had just left. We don't know exactly how long it's been, but it could be 48 hours. This may not be a long period of time between these events. It's about a 5-hour boat trip from the southern edge back up. So who knows, maybe it's around noon by this time or the night before. We're not quite exactly sure. And let's think about the three main characters of last time's story and the two main characters in this story. You have the Gerasene demoniac, you have the woman with the issue of blood, and you have a dead child. The demoniac, where did he live?
He lived
in the graves, in the tombstones, among the dead. So he is ritually unclean. The woman, because she has an issue of blood, is ritually unclean. Jairus' daughter is dead, ritually unclean. There's, again, the positioning of Jesus in these stories is he is going to places where no one else would go. You just stay away from those kind of people. You don't get involved unless you're part of the family, but you're taking your spiritual life at risk according to the Jewish law. So we come to the text, verse 21. Jesus crossed again in the boat to the other side. A great crowd was expecting him, according to Luke. Gathered around him, he's beside the sea, and one of the rulers of the synagogue, Jairus by name, comes and knelt before him. Well, he'd have to stop. Jairus, fine, you know, he's a distraught father, but what's his title? Ruler of the synagogue. Any idea what that means?
Does that mean he has to be Jewish at least, doesn't
it? Well, at least that, okay. Now, he's not a priest.
He just organizes who preaches when.
Yeah, he's like an elder. Okay, he would be, in fact, it actually, they say, he's the one who would choose who would pray and the one who would be reading the scriptures during each service. So there was an element of...
Chairman of the elder
board. Very good. You know, this is an important position. And in a small town where you have one major place of worship, that is a position of great honor and great distinction. There has to be elements of character, elements of holiness, all these things that go into that. And if you think about later in the New Testament, when Paul is writing about the requirements of an elder, yeah, granted, we follow that pattern, but Paul wasn't thinking of Camelback Bible Church when he was writing that. He was thinking about the believers in the first church, basing much of that on what had come before. So you kind of can see the parallels here. It's very interesting. And he is kneeling, not in worship at this point, but in honoring or homage to Jesus, who's an enemy, or at least a radical. The Pharisees and scribes are still around. They're still trailing behind and watching everything that's going on. And now the head of the elder board, Again, it's one of those other details we tend to miss in this. What he is doing here is extraordinary. He is setting aside all of what he had risen to as a layperson for his daughter. His daughter's illness trumped all of that. He said, I don't care. And imagine, if he's up in Capernaum, in the synagogue area, he's heard about Jesus. I mean, at least MSNBC was out. You know, someone was televising this event. I mean, if he had not actually seen him, he had heard about it and knew that Jesus has been healing people. Second picture to put in your mind. There is a crowd. Well, define the crowd. Well, we don't know what that means. But if we put 100 people in this room, it would be cramped. We could mill around, but we'd be bumping into each other, and it'd be a little uncomfortable and be a little sweaty, and you know, we'd be wondering why they don't open these doors so we can spread out a little bit. But imagine a group pressing, and Jairus makes his way to the front and kneels in front of everybody and says, please come help my daughter. I came across this, and I did not know this, but did you know that Martin Luther lost a 14-year-old daughter named Magdalena during the plague of the 16th century? I had no idea. You know, you see the Martin Luther of history and realizing that there was tragedy in his life as well. And there's so many of us in our congregation, in our families, that have had similar tragedies. And the heart goes out. There's a powerful emotional aspect to this scene. This is the Father saying, please do something for my daughter. Come and lay hands on her so that she may be made well and live. Interesting. Some commentators like to pull this apart and go, well, he didn't have enough faith like the centurion did. Because the centurion said, just say it and she'll be healed. And Jairus said, you got to come and touch her. Okay. Now we're getting into semantics. There's still that element of faith that Jesus is going to have the power to do something. The other thing is that we have her identified as 12 years old. Do you realize that 12 years plus one day is the bat mitzvah? That's when they're made a woman. So she is a woman. And yet, he in Mark calls her little. Well, Fiona's going to be 27. She's my little girl. You know, she's the little one, you know, but there is that endearment element that isn't lost. If we look at it carefully, there's a term here of absolute love and concern. Now, in our society, this would mean she was a junior higher, probably seventh grade or thereabouts. And you have pictures of that age group, and you can almost see the picture. It begins to take shape. And so, the story continues, verse 24. How did Jesus respond? Look, I'll schedule you for next Tuesday. Can you be at my house at 9? No. He says, I will come with you. Do you want me to change the temperature in here? Because you're starting to do this, and you're starting to do this, and you've been doing this since we came in here. And Christine's going, oh my gosh, it's so hot in here. Okay, I can't make everybody happy. Oh, funny. There we go. It should turn itself off here. It was set at 73, so that's a little chilly. Anyway. You don't realize what I'm looking at up here.
Now you know how Jesus
felt. Yeah, exactly. And this crowd is...
Same as us.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. Well, Jesus says, okay, I'll go with you. Well, a great crowd followed him, thronged about him, and Luke says, almost crushed him. Now, there have been movie depictions of this scene. Everything from Jesus Christ Superstar to Mel Gibson's The Passion of Christ. And there is that pressing scene where they're just all milling around. He's trying to make his way through, and you can imagine Peter, James, and John and the other disciples are sitting here trying to be bodyguards, you know, saying, come on, you know, we've got to keep moving here. And then the story changes. Jesus is on his way on a task to save a young girl from death. And the story changes. All three Gospels pick this up. This is the other aspect of it. This isn't some unique story that only we have one witness of. This is all of them are saying this. And there's this woman who's had a discharge of blood for 12 years. Now, how old was the girl?
12.
The woman has had this problem for 12 years. It made me run back to the Gerizim demoniac because I wanted to see, is the word 12 in here anywhere? Because I thought there's got to be something. There isn't, but it makes you wonder. How long was that man terrorized if there's this kind of coincidence, if we want to call it that? So I started thinking about 12 years. Imagine you have been ill with something, a chronic illness of some sort, like this, where you're having a constant blood flow for 12 years. 12 years ago, in April, was April 2003. Now stop for a minute and just picture where you were in your life in April 2003. You don't need to tell me. I've already gone through the exercise in my own head. And so I started looking up some of the things that happened 12 years ago this month. Michael Jordan retired. That's a big deal. We were 1 month into the Iraq War, and Baghdad had just fallen. Pat Tillman was still alive. Just had the Pat Tillman run yesterday. The Dixie Chicks, who are they? Who cares? But at that time, they were at the top and running a huge protest against the war and doing all sorts of things, but now they're completely forgotten. Apple announced a new software program called iTunes 12 years ago, 2 days from now, April 28th. And the entire music industry has changed in 12 years because of it. 12 years ago, plus 1 month, I left Bethany House to become a literary agent. And it's just, oh my goodness, that's a long time ago. So imagine, and here we don't know the age of this woman, but what if she had begun this chronic bleeding when she had turned 12. So her adult life has been dealing with this problem. We don't know, again, because she could be much older. We really have no idea what her age is. And so you start thinking through, all right, she is struggling emotionally because every day she's dealing with this chronic illness. She's struggling mentally because it's all she can think about. Anybody with any form of chronic illness, there's a daily reminder of the lot that you're in. She's in financial distress. It says, she had suffered under many physicians and had spent all that she had. Obamacare did not help her. Go ahead.
In modern parlance, she would have had iron deficiency, I'm sure.
Very likely. You know, we don't know what it is. Now, it's interesting. This is not as uncommon of an ailment as you might think. The Talmud actually has a series of cures for this type of ailment. 11 of them. They include: take 3 pints of Persian onions and boil them in wine and drink it and say, "Arise from thy flux." I'm not kidding. If this doesn't work, set her in a place where two ways meet and let her hold a cup of wine in her right hand and let someone come up behind her and frighten her and say, "Arise from thy flux."
That's for hiccups.
Yeah, that's for
hiccups. That's for hiccups, exactly.
Without the wine.
Without the wine, in the left hand. This had to be in the right hand. Or carry the ashes of ostrich eggs in a linen rag during the summer or in a cotton rag in the winter and say, "Arise from thy flux." This is from the Talmud. I'm not making this up. Or the favorite is carry around an ear of corn found in the dung of a white donkey. Yeah, hi. My name's Sally. What in the world? We laugh at this because we have modern medicine. This is what year? What, 31? A.D. You know, you have certain elements of the physician world was beginning to start getting some sort of scientific thing, but you know, we're still 1,000 years later in the medieval eras as they would bleed you to try to heal you of something. And this is not exactly exciting. It's interesting that Luke writes about this. And he's a physician, and I left it out in my verse 26. Luke adds the phrase, "She could not be healed by anyone." He took up this idea that she had suffered under many physicians, and as a physician, probably realized, you know, she's gone through every doctor in town, every doctor in the region. They've all tried these various things and nothing is working. She either has a terminal disease or it's simply incurable.
Another thing is that Ray suffered under many physicians means that not only did she not get healing or relief, she most likely had various side effects or other trauma caused by the physicians themselves.
Oh, that's very, very possible. And she's just a mess. Now, on top of all this, because of the nature of her illness, she defiles everyone she touches, according to Jewish law. So she can't have any social interaction with people. And lastly, she's barred from the temple while she has this issue of blood. So for the last 12 years, she hasn't even been able to go to church. Every aspect, physical, mental, emotional, financial, societal, and spiritual, is taken away from this woman. She is desperate. Absolutely desperate. Now, within Greek culture, which is still prevalent in the area, there was a belief of magic, that you get the magical sorcerer or sage or whatever, and if you could touch something that they had blessed, you could be healed. We still see that on Christian TV where someone says, you know, touch the screen and I'll heal you through it, or I'll pray for this handkerchief and if you send me $100, I'll send you the handkerchief and it'll heal you. I've seen them and we read about them and go, oh, come on. Well, they wouldn't do it if they didn't get money. So there's still people believing it because people like this, desperate, they will do anything. And yet, within all of that, she knows that Jesus is a very special person. And she has the belief that if she can just get close enough, because she knows that probably if she gets in the way, she'll just get pushed aside. Or she's so shunned by people that they're all just kind of, like leper. They know who she is. She's not some stranger to the community. So she sneaks up, and it says here, came up behind Jesus and touched the edge of his garment. Now there's lots of descriptions and lots of theory of what it meant by that. Matthew and Luke talk about the tassels. Every devout Jewish man would wear an outer cloak that had tassels on the four corners. These were, it's actually found in, where is it? I got it written down. Get to my right place. Numbers 15, verses 38 through 40, and Deuteronomy 22, 12 talks about putting four tassels on your cloak to, as a sign of your devoutness. And so that would be there, and if she could touch that edge, she would be touching his garment. If I just touch the clothes, I'll be healed. So she did. Verse 29, immediately the flow of blood dried up. She felt it. That's dramatic. I've not had that experience. I mean, there's times where I feel better, but not where I can actually feel something suddenly heal. I don't know if any of you had that experience, but there's, wow, she knew immediately, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. And the word disease here, the very last word in verse 29, is the same word for the Greek word for scourge or whip. It is just this horrible thing, and she is healed of that. Jesus, verse 30, perceiving in himself that power had gone out of him, immediately, same word as in verse 29, stops, turns to the crowd, and says, "Who touched me?" Now, I just said it in one certain inflection, kind of angry. Or it could have said, "Who touched me?" There's lots of ways you could read that word. And I just love the reaction of the disciples around him, Peter and the others. Who didn't touch you, Jesus? My gosh, the people are crowding around you, bumping into us. This is a scrum. We're like in a rugby match. Hey, we need to invent rugby so we can make that phrase real. But it's just this push and shove, and he's saying, "What do you mean who touched you? Everybody's touching you."
What do you mean?
Yeah, what do you mean? Exactly. Who touched me? I mean, seriously, there's this, the picture is, again, very dramatic, but Jesus stops. Now, wait a minute. He is in an ambulance on the way, in the paramedic truck, on the way to save a girl's life. Let's just stop for a moment. He stops. Jairus continues walking. And he turns around and Jesus is going, "Who touched me?" He's like, I was here first. We don't see that. That's another thing. For Jairus, we don't see him in this story at all. I think that's significant, actually. Very significant. He's willing to wait. Because Jesus is who Jesus is. But Jesus stops. He says, "Who touched me?" Why did he ask that?
To bring the woman out.
That's one theory. To bring the woman out. Why?
She needed to confront him.
She needed to be blessed or confronted. Or, as one commentator very adroitly brought up, he needed to make sure she didn't say it was magic. Like the Greeks. Touch the garment. You can imagine the story would spread. Just touch his garment and you'll be healed. And then suddenly it changes the nature of the divine miracle. So that's one element. But also as a witness to the crowd.
Yes. Hmm? I was going to say that, and not only on the behalf of, for glory to God, but it absolves her in the crowd, because no matter how unclean she was, no matter how much they knew, she had been a recipient of one of Jesus' miracles, and he had acknowledged that she had touched her, and you know, all those things. So they saw, there were witnesses, eyewitnesses to the transaction.
I'll ask you all a question, another question that kind of comes up when we think about this. Jesus says he felt the power, the dunamis, the dynamite, go out of him. Okay. Don't you find that odd? An odd phraseology? Does that mean every time Jesus healed the human portion of him, there was that strength, that was something was taken away? He felt it? Or, I mean, am I overstating this? But this is one of the only places we see this action of something going out and him feeling it. Imagine what it was like on the cross, where every part of that well, that being, which was flowing out for all of humanity and forever, of all time, the reservoir was huge, but it was all gone on the cross, because there was nothing left and he died. Here, he even felt the tiniest touch of the tassel of his robe. Man, I find that very cool, actually. It's just one of those, go ahead.
I think this one statement, daughter, your faith has healed you, I think he wanted to change what she thought healed her, and it wasn't just the touching.
Right. Right. I mean, he wanted to make sure she understood that it was her faith. Because this begs the question, if it was magic, if it was just the act of touching his robe or the left tassel on the back side, because the other three tassels didn't work. You know, I mean, just think of the, oh, that's the magic one. If you can get up on his left side from behind, you're going to be healed. That's just weird. But you never know how people are going to respond to news like this. It also changes the, because I even wrote here, why didn't the other people get healed? Because they were touching him all over the place. They were bumping into him, constant, just the going through this crowd. None of them got healed. Well, we see that in what you just read. Your faith. The others were either, they were there for the entertainment, or their faith wasn't really in Jesus. It was in something else. So we don't really know that dynamic, but it's fascinating to kind of pull it apart and just ask these questions. What is going on here?
Well, their faith still could have been strong, but that wasn't their intent at the time. I mean, when Jesus is all she's seeking and there's nothing else, and blind to everything else.
Well, that's true. That's a good way of looking at it. She had a one-track mind. She was totally focused on this.
Seek me with all your, you know, it's constant. Seek me above all else. Seek me above everything else. When that happens, God always responds. Maybe not only do we always recognize, but if there's nothing but Jesus that we're holding on to, there are promises in that cross.
You know, you think about that. There's that. The, I don't know if it's an adage, but the idea that if once everything that you have is stripped away and there is nothing left except Jesus, then you finally wake up and realize how important he is. You know, there are some times where when we are very full and very happy and all things are well, he kind of becomes an accessory. But when it's all gone, all hope was lost for this woman. She, the rest of her life was going to be horrific, and she knew it. But there was this one chance. And she didn't want, however, to confront him. She wanted to kind of do it in secret and not anybody know. So the story continues. Jesus turns around and looks to see who had done it, verse 32. The woman, realizing that she couldn't go unnoticed, imagine again the scene, right? Jesus is walking like this. She touches, he keeps going a few steps and he goes around, "Who touched me?" And he just starts doing this. "Oh, it's you." And she's, because it says, she comes to him in fear and trembling. She is shaking. Either I've done something really wrong, or I am so overwhelmed, I am healed. And she now comes forward, the unloved, the defiled one, comes forward, and Jesus looks at her, and she tells him the whole story. He already knew the story. Jesus is God. He knew the story.
But he needed confession.
He needed the confession, and he needed the testimony for the crowd. Even if she was whispering it, everyone around would have gone deathly still, going, "He picked her out of the crowd. What's going on?" And they're going to listen to every word. And she explains it, and they're all going, "Oh yeah, we know her. She's, you know, she's that one." And then he says to her, "Take heart, daughter. This is the only time in the entire Gospels where Jesus addresses a woman with the word daughter. He didn't say woman, because that's the norm to talk to a stranger. He says daughter, family member,
child of God.
We are one. Oh my goodness sake. It's one of these things we kind of gloss over, saying, "Oh, isn't that nice?" No, wait a minute. He doesn't call any other woman in his lifetime that we have as a record daughter. It's a very intentional word, and all three Gospels use it. So there were many witnesses to it. There's no way you can say he didn't say it. He picks her out, says, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Shalom." He says, "Go in peace," to a woman who has not known peace for 12 years. Well, I go back to our little trip down memory lane of the last 12 years of your life, and imagine either something like this or whatever has been happening to you in your life, or in the lives of those around you that have affected you spiritually, emotionally, physically, financially, all these things, and then realizing that the whole time God has been waiting and God has been there, and now he says, "Peace be with you. Go in peace, daughter, son," however you want to look at it, "and be healed of your scourge, your whip, your illness." Amazing. You know, it's one of those times where you want to kind of say, "Okay, well, we can stop." But we can't, because we're in the middle of the story. That's what's so incredible about this. There's this enormous conclusion, this triumphant moment. And at that point, right when he's saying, "Go in peace, your faith has made you well," everybody's, "Yay, so happy, yeah, and it's cool." And this messenger runs up and goes, "Jairus, your daughter just died." And the crowd goes silent again. And they turn to Jesus. "Why'd you stop the ambulance? If you had just kept going. I mean, they're basically saying, don't even bother. Don't even bother coming. She's gone. But overhearing what they say, Jesus says to Jairus, do not fear. Only believe. And then Luke adds, and she will be healed. Again, really powerful words that you can apply in anything when you get that news. Fill in the blank. Do not fear.
Seems like the situation with Lazarus.
Only believe.
When they came and said.
Very similar.
He would have lived.
And that was later. This is earlier. Yeah. And it's just, there's this parallel in what's going on. So he allows no one to follow him. So somehow he was able to extricate them from the crowd, probably saying, look, we're going to have to hustle. You know, so we'll just make the crowd a little smaller. So Peter, James, John, and the mother and the father. First time the mother is mentioned, by the way. She's not been mentioned up until this point. She's obviously been there, otherwise she wouldn't be mentioned right now. And they take off. They come to the house of the ruler of the synagogue, and Jesus saw a commotion. And flute players. I'm sorry. I mean, that's what Matthew says, and flute players. You want to go, okay, so commotion equals flute players. Sorry, flute players. You know, the trumpet players weren't there, but the flute players, they were making an awful noise. Oh, yeah.
Kind of a dirge.
Oh, exactly. This is, in fact, part of the tradition in these days. Even poor had to hire flute players and mourners. So when the death occurred, they turn on the tears and start wailing and thrashing around, and just part of the culture. I'm quoting from William Barclay. He says, flute players were essential. Throughout most of the ancient world, in Rome, Greece, Phoenicia, Assyria, and in Palestine, the wailing of the flute was inseparably connected with death and tragedy. Now realize, these aren't the nice, beautiful metal flutes with the keys that we have now. These are more the recorder type with the holes drilled in them. So it's a little different, a different tone. It was laid that down that however poor a man was, he must have at least two flute players at his wife's funeral. One dictionary of Christ in the Gospels quotes two interesting uses of the flute player to show how widespread the custom was. There were flute players at the funeral of Claudius, the Roman emperor, and in AD 67, news reached Jerusalem of the fall of Jotapata to the Roman armies, and Josephus tells us that most people engaged flute players to lead their lamentations. So every time one of our flute players plays, we can all go, oh, well, they're practicing for their next dirge. No.
It's like bagpipes are kind of used.
There are a little bit more now, but that's just because they're different, very unusual. You have things what happens to the mourners, for example. When death comes, a mourner was forbidden to work, to anoint himself, or even to wear shoes. The poorest man, even the poorest man, had to seek work for 3 days, was not allowed to travel with goods, and the prohibition from work extended even to his servants. He must sit with his head bound up, he must not shave or do anything for his comfort, he must not read the law or the prophets, not even the scriptures, because that would bring him joy. Isn't that interesting?
Where's these rules from?
This is the Jewish Talmud.
Really?
Yeah. This is part of their ritual. He was allowed to read Job, Jeremiah, and Lamentations, but not any of the other scriptures. He must eat only in his own house, must abstain from flesh and wine. He must not leave the town or the village for 30 days. He must not eat at a table, but eat sitting on the floor using the chair as a table. And it's a custom, apparently, which still survives, to eat eggs dipped in ashes and salt.
I thought their tables were really long.
That would be Well, that would be more of the ancient, that would be some of those were that kind of low table where you recline, but you weren't allowed to recline because that's comfortable.
Eating on a chair.
You have to sit on the floor and the chair is your table.
The chair being a cushion, you know, all the time.
Oh, no. No, you're sitting on the floor and the chair, you're eating like this because you can't sit and be comfortable. I don't know, it's just weird.
What she's saying is, I think, John, are you saying that, you know, they did all reclining, so the impression was there were no table and chairs?
Oh, but there were table and chairs, it's just not at the dinner table. The dinner table you would recline. Yeah, so it's like a separate part of the house. At least that's what I would understand it. Bottom line is, if you're going to be into mourning, you're going to make a big show of it. Everybody's got to know. So Jesus sees this big commotion and the flute players. People weeping, wailing loudly. And he comes up and he goes, "Why are you making such a commotion and weeping? Stop wailing," or in Matthew, "go away. The child is not dead, but sleeping." I'll get back to that in a second, because the next verse is fascinating, and it's repeated in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. They laughed at him. These people weren't sad. They're mourners, they're wailers, they're professionals. They're, yeah, go away, man. You know what you're talking about. Let us do our job. Seriously, this is the picture I have in my head. This isn't family members. These are the pros. These are the professional mourners. They hear this and go, "We know what a dead person looks like. Come on. We do this for a living." And Jesus says, "Nah, he's only asleep." Now, commentators, pastors, teachers, scholars go into enormous gyrations in dealing with that statement. Because if she's dead for real, why would he say she's just asleep? So that would then say, well, he knew she was just in a coma, so he really didn't raise her from the dead. That's one theory. Thing is that there's three ways to interpret the word kathudo, which is sleep. It can be literally asleep, as in, you know, Jesus was kathudo in the boat during the storm. He was asleep. Wasn't dead. Wasn't in a coma. He was snoring. He was asleep. The second is that it could be figurative. In 1 Thessalonians 5:6, there's the idea of sleep is being used very figuratively. Then the third sense is the sense of sleep as being a form of death. Someone's not happy. Wow.
Wish they were asleep.
Yes. Are you speaking figuratively? No. Wait a minute. Wrong time to bring that up right now. But in this particular sense, and it's also in 1 Thessalonians 5, you have sleep being used figuratively and sleep being used literally as meaning dead in the same paragraph. So you have the same word having two meanings in Paul's writings to the Thessalonians in the paragraph of 1 Thessalonians 5. So it's kind of confusing. Jesus here means she is dead, but it's not permanent. That's what he's saying. She's just asleep. She is dead, but meaning she will wake, and you don't believe that. You don't believe I have the power to do that. That's what I am here for. So the story continues, verse 41. They all go into the room where the child was, leaving the wailers outside. Now imagine, the wailers continue their job. So they don't go silent because Jesus told them to go away, because they've just laughed at him, saying, just stop this. And It reminds me of the people in the Gerasenes who were afraid after Jesus healed the demoniac. They came up to him and said, "Could you just go away? You're making us uncomfortable." Kind of as that. This time, Jesus comes in and they go, "You're an idiot. Just go away." He goes, "No, you go away. I'll tell you what, you stay out here. I'll go inside with Peter, James, and John and the mother and the father, and we'll take care of things." They then continue. So you're hearing this cacophony of noise on the outside of the wailing and gnashing of teeth, kind of like the child we just listened to. Right outside the door. And there's going on while he comes in. Verse 41, takes her by the hand and says, in Aramaic, everything's been Greek up to this point, "Talitha kumi." Now, why would we have the language change here? Aramaic is the language of the people. Aramaic is what's spoken every day. Could it be that Talitha kumi is what mom said to her every morning? Wake up. It's time to get up. Because it means, my child, arise. Now, usually when it's a junior hire, you're not saying, "My child, arise." No, "Get out of bed, you lazy bum. We're going to be late for school." You know, it's a little bit of a different thing here, but you get the general idea. It wouldn't be quite so exciting if the phrase was, get up, you lazy slob. You know, that wouldn't, it wouldn't quite have the same impact, but anyway. We can have fun with that, can't we? Okay, not the usual words to use to say to wake a junior hire, but I think it is a way to show the language of the people, a common phrase that would not be translatable really in the same endearing phrase of "my child arise." Talitha kumi just has a better, it's poignant, I guess would be a good word. "I say to you, arise." Luke says, "Her spirit returned." Luke the physician, she was dead. Spirit returned, and immediately, this is the third time we see the word immediately in our passages, the girl got up and began walking around. She's 12 years old. And they, her parents, were immediately, same word, fourth time now, overcome with amazement. And that's the word exestimai, which means to be astonished with great astonishment. They were just overwhelmed. And they're exuberant. They're just, "Oh my goodness, this is just incredible." And Jesus says two things. One, just don't say anything about this. And two, could you get her something to eat? She's 12. She's been sick for a while. She's probably hungry. Don't forget to feed her because I don't want to have to come back. No, he didn't say that. But why, down here, he tells the demoniac, the healed demoniac, go tell everybody. Go home. Now, we're here. We're inside the house. And he says, don't tell anybody. Help me. Help me understand why, within 48 hours, we've got two very different responses to a miracle.
Well, up there, they were mobbing him, and all so many believed he didn't want the overwhelming everybody coming to him. Probably were down there. They were not believing.
Well, they said go away.
Yeah, right, go away. So I would say that.
That's probably very accurate. And Matthew, the very last verse I have in our thing here, shows that the secret didn't stay.
Right. No, they always did it.
The mourners would have known, because they would have gone, wait a minute, why are they shrieking and yelling and clapping inside? What's going on? And someone says, well, she's alive. We're like, what? No. There's again, I've read probably five or six different variations. I don't have an answer for this. personally.
You mentioned the last time we were talking about this one thing, that he was in an area for foreign missions.
Right.
As opposed to...
As opposed to here, where he's been ministering for quite some time in Galilee. Yeah.
And the little girl is the daughter of the elder of the church.
Right, so everybody at church knew she died. Right.
They're going to find out about it next week when she shows up for Sunday school.
Awesome.
Well, the word had spread anyway.
The word would spread, but it wouldn't be that immediate, as if it was grandstanding. So there wasn't this, it wasn't an opportunity for him to come out the door and say, "See what I've done? Ta-da!" It was a, "I'm taking care of you. Let's just keep it cool for now." And then it goes out, because we've talked about this before. Jesus was very concerned about the timing to be right in the accomplishment of his ministry. We are still in year two of his ministry. We're about to shift over to year three. So you've got this, there's still a lot to come in the still many miracles that he begins to perform. But in this particular case, he's just saying, let's just not make this a spectacle. Let's make it what it is. Well, it looks like we have run out of time. So, yes.
In other instances of telling of Jesus healing somebody, are there other references to energy leaving his body?
No. This is the only place where that's what I was saying, it's so odd, because there's no other explanation at any other time where he does something that he feels it happening, that he says it.
He says it.
It may have been happening.
Yeah.
We just don't know it. So it's a hint into maybe what the toll was on him physically.
He often had his little rest, though. Remember, he would have to leave the crowd, so it was probably happening, and he had.
Yeah, and yet the only time we ever see him sleeping is in the middle of a storm.
Right. So he was tired.
Another indirect instance of his power was when they came to arrest him, and John records that I am he, and they fall back. He speaks, and then they come back. So there is always some sort of power going on, whether it's through his vocal command or through the word or through his song. So there's another instance of, whoa, that's an indication of something.
And I don't know if this is a parallel, but I think of when he's in the Garden of Gethsemane, he is praying, and it's such an intense battle that he is sweating blood.
Right.
This isn't, I can get pretty intense, but I've never sweated blood. That never anything like that. So there is some connection between the physical and the divine, the human and the divine. It's just a mystery to us. But this is the only incident where we actually have him say, "This has happened," which, like I said, is a hint that maybe this was going on all the time.
Yeah, I was thinking about Jairus is that you cannot refute the fact of God working. You cannot deny that, You may not be able to describe it or maybe understand it, but he knew this was God's power.
The other thing that I find fascinating, I'm glad you brought this up, because I actually wrote a little note and I forgot about it until just now. We don't have recorded here Jairus' faith, other than the fact that he lowered himself, paid homage to Jesus, and said, "Please, you've got to come." So there's that element of faith, but there's no comment after. Nothing. It's just the healing. Be quiet about it. We don't have any other instance, no other record, no other comment, nothing about Jairus and whatever happened. But as you said, you can't deny this. So he's now the chairman of the elder board in the synagogue in a very influential town in northern Galilee. Everybody who comes through that area, "I've heard about this Jesus fellow. Yeah, he raised the elder's daughter from the dead." "What? No. Yeah, we were there. It's just amazing." He says he's the Son of God. You can almost just see the seeds that are planted and how that works. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful picture. And you cannot deny the facts that are here. And what I love too is that this, again, is one of those passages where all three Gospels are in concert with the power of what has happened to two people. Actually three. Demoniac, ill woman, daughter, now, and a daughter, a small girl. Wow, incredible. All right, let's pray. Lord, thank you for our time together. Your word is so full, we could stay here, talk about it, enjoy it, revel in it for hours. And still, still not plumb its depths. Thank you for giving it to us. We praise you, we honor you, we worship you. As we move into our time of formal worship, let us lift our eyes, lift our hearts, and see the miracle that you have done within us and give you all the praise, glory, and honor. In Jesus' name, amen.